Please turn in your Bibles tonight to the book of Habakkuk once again. We want to study from chapter 2. We did not go very far in our last lesson. We only went down through verse 4. But I think that we will probably go farther tonight. There will begin in verse 6 the woes of the second chapter. You might find it to some benefit if you'd go down beginning there at verse 6 all the way down through verse 19. And you'll find the word woe, I believe, about five times, if I remember. And so there is going to begin here what we call the fivefold woes. These woes are pronounced upon the Chaldean invaders. They are a judgment of God upon them. Nevertheless, the woes that are pronounced are also against all people that are guilty of the sins that are condemned here in the verses that we'll look at. So it's not just something that is applicable to the Babylonian Empire that lived thousands of years ago, but there are some moral principles set forth that are applicable to our remote day, principles that are applicable to any generation during which men may live. So there is a lesson here for us, is what I want you to understand. Beginning here at verse 5, all the way down through verse 8, we have woe to the plunder, for he will be spoiled. We might say woe to the spoiler, for he will be spoiled. We're told in the 5th verse the kinds of persons that deserve God's judgment. And while the reference is primarily to the Chaldeans, it's certainly also to be applied to people of our time. Yea, also because he transgressed by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. So we're going to see here the rather graphic description of those persons that deserve the judgment of God. He starts out by dealing with those that are guilty of the sin of drunkenness. He said, he transgresseth by wine. The Bible warns many times of the abuse of alcoholic drinks. In Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 1, the Bible says, wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. To put it in more modern English, King Solomon is saying, anyone that takes alcoholic drinks to excess is a fool. He said not wise, he used a milder term, but he really was saying that he's a fool. There are many statements in the book of Proverbs concerning the excessive use of alcohol, like in the 23rd chapter of that same book in verse 32. And at the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Some years ago, based on this verse, I wrote a tract, A Snake in a Bottle. And really that's what it is. It's a snake in a bottle. It's a serpent's bite. There's much said about, though, the evil of excessive drinking throughout the Old Testament as well as the New. In Isaiah 28 in verse 7, but they also have erred through wine. The way that reads, they would not have made the mistakes that they did had they been sober. But they have also erred through wine, and through strong drink are they out of the way. The priests and the prophets have erred through strong drink. They are swallowed up of wine. They go out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. And certainly it has come to light in the last few years that we have pretty much the same problem that Israel did of old. We have men in our government that are more or less alcoholics. Furthermore, we have even preachers that are alcoholics. There was a famous faith healer of some 10 years ago, A.A. Allen, that died from an overdose of alcohol. That was reported in all the secular papers, so I don't need to hide out when I say it. It was reported on the radio and television and printed in the press. In recent time, we have learned of some other prominent TV evangelists and the like that like their liquor as well as some other things. So our society today is not a great deal different than what it was in Isaiah's time. He said the priests and the prophets have erred through strong drink. And so we still have some of that going on. The idea is that these errors would not be committed if they had remained sober men, which they had not done. And then I think about another statement in the Old Testament bearing on this. In the book of Hosea, it shows some of the evil of drinking, all of these verses that I'm showing you. In chapter 4 and verse 11, whoredom and wine and new wine take away the heart. And I would just make one observation here. There are some people that tell me that the new wine in the Bible is grape juice. They better read their Bibles better, because the new wine as well as the old wine here takes away the heart. And if they'd like a little more proof, all they got to do is go to Acts chapter 2. And it was alleged there that those people that were speaking in tongues were drunk on new wine. Now, if new wine is grape juice, how did they get drunk? See? Well, what it is, new wine is just fresh wine, and the other wine is old wine. But it's all wine. Incidentally, if you want to have a little fun sometime, try to find an English dictionary that says that the word wine means grape juice. Now, if you find one, you let me know. I've never found one yet. You say, well, what word would we look up to find the word for grape juice? Must, M-U-S-T. Squeezed out grape juice is must. But when it's gone through the process of fermentation, whether it's new wine or old wine, doesn't make any difference. It is fermented wine. And it's wine. And it takes away the heart. That's what we're being warned of here. The new wine as well as the old wine, it takes away the heart. So it does have an alcoholic content. There's no doubt about it, the way that passage reads there. And you note that whoredom is connected with wine. And most of the people that are involved in whoredom are also involved in drinking. It all goes together. Another place in the writings of Solomon, it said that those that drink wine, their eyes will behold strange women. So again, he was showing how that it all goes together, you see. So there's a warning here about people that get drunk. People that take wine to the excess. Those that transgress by wine will be subjected to the judgment of God. They will be judged in their bodies now, and judged in their souls hereafter. But there will be a judgment of God for all that take wine to the excess. So wine deprives one of right reason and lays a man open to pride and deception. So therefore, taken to the excess, it's a terrible thing. You know, I know from history as well as the Bible, like in Daniel 5 and verse 1, one of the great besetting sins of ancient Babylon was getting drunk on wine. As a matter of fact, the very night that the kingdom fell, because of the invasion of Cyrus, the Persian, it was during the time that Belshazzar had everybody drunk on wine that he sent soldiers under the river there, under the iron gates, and opened the gates, and they took the city that night. And so it was all because somebody was drunk. And really the reason why that Pearl Harbor was bombed so successfully by the Japanese was that all of the people that were supposed to be flying those planes and on guard were drunk. It's a little known fact, but it's a well-attested fact. If you want to know the truth about it, that's what the truth is. They were all drunk, and that's why the enemy was able to come in and do the damage that he did in a short space of time. I didn't say they all were, but the vast majority was, and many of the leaders were, and everybody was in a state of confusion, and that's what happened, because they transgressed by wine. That's what the trouble was. Now, looking at the immediate context, those that transgress by wine, as well as what follows here, he is a proud man. You know how that pride there and drinking is going together too. So anybody that is haughty and proud will be judged. And pride as well as public drunkenness seem to go together. As a matter of fact, there's at least one place in the Bible that they're put together in one verse. Look in Isaiah 28 in verse 1. And you'll see how that excessive drinking and pride are put together in one verse. Just like in our text there in Habakkuk. Woe to the crown of pride to the drunkards of Ephraim. The drunkards there are also said to be the crown of pride. So not only do you have the loss of right reason, but you also have pride involved in drinking. And that's clearly seen in the Bible. And so there's quite a condemnation here about those that get involved in drunkenness and those that get involved in pride, because he plainly says in this text, he also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man. And then there's still a further description of one that's going to be judged of God, and that's the man that can't be satisfied. That's really what we see in the next part of the verse. Neither keepeth at home. You know, the Bible talks about how mothers are to be keepers at home. That is a normal, natural way. Sometimes it must be otherwise because of circumstance. But that is a normal, natural way that it ought to be. The Scripture is clear on that particular point. But here it's speaking about the men not being keepers at home. And there's not anything in the Bible that necessarily says that they are to be keepers at home. So there must be something else meant. He's speaking about the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. What would it mean because a man was not a keeper at home? Well, that would mean that a man was not content to have a house of his own. He wanted the houses of other people. He wanted to be a conqueror. He wanted to be an invader. He wanted to engage in conquest. That's what it would mean. He wanted to enrich himself at the expense of less fortunate people in the world. And so he goes out and engages in all of these conquests. And that's exactly what the Babylonians were doing. They were a bunch of drunks. They were a bunch of proud people. And they were determined to make a conquest of the whole world. Satan's always behind world conquerors. I don't care who they are. Whether they're Alexander the Great, or the Caesars of Rome, or the Ptolemies of Egypt, or Adolf Hitler, or anyone else living in this generation. They're all being energized and led on by Satan. Because Satan wants to gain control of the whole world. And he's going to do that under the Antichrist, according to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. But let's thank God that it'll not be until that time, hopefully. But now here's a man that cannot have his desire satisfied. Look at the rest of this verse. Who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied. So here's a man that nothing will satisfy. Now what does it mean when it says his desires are as hell? that's a manner of speaking, but what does it mean? Have you ever thought about the word there, Sheol, in the Hebrew? It means the unseen world, where the spirits go at death when they're disembodied. There's something about Sheol, when people go there, they don't come out. In other words, the dead don't rise again until the resurrection. So what I'm telling you is that people that are disembodied, that their immortal spirit is always going to the unseen world, but they don't come back. So it would seem, just by that fact alone, that the unseen world is insatiable. That it just keeps devouring and devouring, and it never gives up. And the same thing is true of death. Here you have death and hell in one verse, just like you have it elsewhere in the Bible. Death is always taking people out of this world. It never brings any back. It always is taking away, and it never brings back. Think about that. And the Bible speaks about how that death is always devouring the human race. Think about some of the statements about Sheol, or hell, as it's translated here. There is one passage in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 14, that says, Sheol has enlarged herself and opened her mouth without measure to receive people, as if it could not be satisfied, you see. And then in Proverbs 27, in verse 20, we're told that hell is never full. Just keeps taking people on down, but it's never full, you see. People are afraid they're going to run out of space down there. They're not. It's never going to be filled up. You say, well, what if more and more go all the time? Then it'll enlarge itself. As the Bible said, there's no one going to see a sign down there in hell that says no vacancy. I assure you there'll be room enough for every Christ rejecter in the world, every demon and every fallen angel and every other being that has ever rebelled against God in all the universe. There's no escape from hell for the unsaved. Then he talks about this enlarging the desire. Then he goes on to say after that, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. This is how the Babylonians conquer and oppress people, and that's why God's going to judge them, you see. The Babylonians wanted to take over the whole world. That was their plan, but they didn't carry it out very well, because they became almost a universal kingdom, but not a total universal kingdom in the absolute sense, perhaps. There's one other thing in verse 5 that I'd like to point out. It speaks about something here that we miss in our version, because we don't, says, has enlarged his desire as hell. It may seem strange to you, but the word desire there is the Hebrew word nephesh, the word for soul. The word for soul. So we might read it like this. He has enlarged his soul as hell. Now, why would it use that? The soul becomes like what it loves. And the ruling passion of a man is absorbed by his whole being. Sometimes you've seen somebody and you'll say, well, that individual is full of ambition. Or you may say, well, that person is full of hate. You're saying what? That this passion has permeated over the whole being of the man, that's all he lives for, and that's all he really is. He's ambition or pride or hatred or whatever the case may be. And so what's being brought out here is that the whole man has this insatiable desire of conquest and plundering of other nations. Body, soul, and spirit's given over to the work, you see. Well, let's pass on now to the sixth verse. Shall not all these take up a parable against him? That is, all of these conquered nations mentioned in verse 5. All these people, all these nations. Shall not all these take up a parable against him? A parable's a little story. and a taunting proverb against him and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long, and to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. There's a whole cluster of gems in that, if we can bring it out. And like I said, here is the beginning of the first of the fivefold woes. And essentially stated there in that sixth verse, we're told that proud conquerors will have no joy in what they've gained because they're going to lose it. That's why the woes pronounced upon them. And so when you look at the first part of it, you see how that the conquered people will finally rise up against the conquerors and triumph over them. In other words, the people will rise up and overthrow the Babylonian Empire. And really they did. The Babylonian Empire in its great extent did not last quite 100 years, if my history serves me correct. It was not a very long kingdom. And so in a sense, those conquered people lived to sing the funeral song of the Babylonian Empire, to utter the little proverb and to make the little song about them. Incidentally, it was a funeral song because their nation fell. So the conquered people would finally triumph over Babylon. Babylon would fall, and they would live to sing the funeral song of these mighty conquerors that have marched down through their lands. I especially would call your attention to the statement there, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. An old saying about war, to the victor belongs the spoils. According to God, anything we get that we don't get honestly is not ours. So wealth gotten by oppression is not that of the conqueror. It still belongs to the conquered people in God's sight. And anything that we do not get by honesty is not ours. It's somebody else's. You may get something by gambling. You may get something by stealing. Or you may get something some other way. And if it's not yours and you didn't work by your sweat and your blood to earn it, it's not yours, it's somebody else's. And that's what the woe is about there. Woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. And then he raises the question there, how long? How long will the Babylonians be able to keep what they've got? How long will it be before God will send judgment upon their ungodly heads? Then I've spent considerable time on that last statement there because I had trouble with it when I first read it. To him that ladeth himself with thick clay. I thought, what in the world does that mean? Is that a fellow with a big old sack of clay on his back going around and he's tired and he can't move? What's the meaning of that? Well, at first you might almost get that impression. But there may be another thump there. Think about gold and silver, and that's what conquerors were always out to get. Gold and silver. What is gold and silver? Dirt and dust. It's white and yellow dust. You can call it whatever you want to. That's all it is. It's just dust. And then he compares it to clay. Now, where I grew up down south, we had plenty of red clay. And if you got it on your boots, there was just almost no way to get it off. And if you went out on a day up a muddy road, by the time you got wherever you were going, you had to clean off your boots 4 or 5 times before you got there. And it made it very hard to walk. And so the thought is that all of this conquest, all of these spoils of war that the Babylonians are going to get, that they're going to weigh them down and they won't be able to walk as they ought to. And I'll tell you what, riches oftentimes weigh people down to the point they can't walk as they ought to in this world. That's what the Babylonians were soon to find out. But why did he say thick clay? Why did he use that term, thick clay? Well, I did some archaeological research and I discovered something. The Babylonians had clay tablets. And in these clay tablets, they kept the official records of all the business of Babylon. So if a man borrowed some money or made a pledge, it would be written down in a clay tablet. And so maybe the verse means this, that the Babylonians have been conquering so many people, taking so many pledges, gathering up so many clay tablets that they can't walk. They've got so many. Therefore, it's going to be a burden to them rather than a blessing. They just got so many records of pledges in these clay tablets that they just can't move them around from one place to another. And that may be very well the meaning of it there. I'm not going to be dogmatic, but I'd say that's possibly the real meaning there. I think there's still another meaning, probably a spiritual meaning, and that is that the Babylonians were stacking up quite a debt to the justice of God. And God would eventually, in His providence, reap down their fields. Because riches gotten by dishonesty will surely bring the judgment of God upon the people. As a matter of fact, the law of divine retribution requires that. So what is that law of divine retribution? It's a law that you and I cannot escape. The Bible said if you roll a stone, it'll return unto you. I can give you a few examples. I knew a woman one time that laughed and made fun of another woman because her hair came out. Would you believe the woman that laughed and made fun, her hair came out? That's what I talk about when I speak of the law of divine retribution. I'll give you a few other examples out of the Bible. What did David do? He committed murder and adultery. What did his sons do? The same thing. His conduct came home to him. So what I'm telling you is, if you do somebody else a bad deed, you'll reap the same, and in most cases it'll be multiplied. Don't think you can escape that law of divine retribution. The Babylonians did not escape, and no one ever will or shall. There are many examples of it in the Bible in Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 11. As the potterage sitteth on eggs and hatcheth them not, so he that getteth riches and not by right shall leave them in the midst of his days, and in his end shall be a fool. So then there's problems, you see. Leave it all. You get it one day, you leave it all the next day. In James chapter 5, beginning at verse 1, all the way through verse 6, there's a warning against rich men that have heaped together their treasures for the last day, and they've gotten them by fraud. And it said that the Lord of the Sabaoth will reap down their fields and will deal with them for this ill-gotten gain that they have come into possession of. So the law of divine retribution is sooner or later going to overtake the Babylonians, and that'll even be seen more clearly as we go to the next verse. Let's look now at verse 7. Shall not they rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee, and thou shalt be for booties unto them? It's asked in the form of a question, but it's to be taken in the positive sense, I believe. He's saying that the profits that are gotten by force, men will surely be punished for. He's asking it in the form of a question, but nevertheless, the idea is still the same. The victims of these ruthless conquerors would suddenly rise up and overthrow their oppressors. And they did. In the time of the Medes and the Persians, Babylon fell. Cyrus the Great took it. During the time when Belshazzar was the king, Nabonidus, his father, was out fighting some of the battles trying to protect the city. But the Bible speaks of this law of divine retribution. And we're seeing it how that it comes out here. In Jeremiah 50 and verse 10, this is said about Babylon, if I remember my context. And the Chaldees shall be a spoil. Now, they've been the spoilers in Judah. But now it says, they shall be a spoil. All that spoil her shall be satisfied, saith the Lord. Now, the spoiling Babylonians were not satisfied. We just read that. But those that spoil them will be satisfied. Just the opposite is said there. You remember what Christ said to Peter in Matthew 26 and 52? He said, Peter, put up your sword. He said, all that take the sword will perish with the sword. You remember what was said in the Noah covenant? Whosoever sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. In a sense, that's what Jesus said there in Matthew 26, 52. And then that law of divine retribution is stated even more clearly in Revelation 13 and 10. And there it is said regarding the people of the tribulation time, but certainly true today. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. We call that the law of divine retribution because that's really what it is. And so the idea there is that whatever you do to somebody else, God will do unto you. There was a man in the book of Judges, I believe it's in chapter 1, named Adonbezek. And every time he'd conquer somebody, he'd cut off their big thumbs and their big toes. Well, when the Israelites caught him, what do you think happened to him? They cut off his big thumbs and his big toes. What was that proving? The law of divine retribution. What you do to others, God will do to you. You tell a lie on somebody, somebody will tell a lie on you. You take somebody else's wife, and somebody else will take her away from you. That's the way it goes, you see. That's the law of divine retribution. And sooner or later, all the evil that men do to others, God will do it unto them. You say, well, hadn't happened yet. Just hold on. God never gets in a rush. He's got all eternity to do it. And you better believe this law is true. Men can make light of it. They can make fun of it. But I tell you what, it is as valid as the law of gravity. It is as valid as any law of the land or anything that any man's ever conjured up in his mind. This is one law that always comes to pass. It may take a long time, but it'll surely happen. Now you'll notice there that it speaks of this taking place suddenly. Shall they not rise up suddenly? Rise up suddenly. The judgment of God on sinners is often something that comes suddenly. Think about what Jesus warned concerning his second coming in the 17th chapter of the book of Luke, beginning at verse 27. And look how that he said suddenly, suddenly. Let's start at verse 26 to get the full thought. And as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It happened suddenly. Look at it. Likewise also as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so shall it be when the Son of Man is revealed. Then in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 3, speaking about the awful devastating judgments of the tribulation time, says they'll say peace and safety and sudden destruction shall come upon them as travaileth upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. So God's judgment always comes suddenly. It came suddenly in the days of Noah. It came suddenly in the time of Lot and Sodom. It will come suddenly during the time of the seven-year tribulation in the future. So people say, well, God's never going to do anything. He will. He'll do something all of a sudden like when you least expect it. Then we quickly want to look at verse 8. And finish our first woe here. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. The spoiler will be spoiled. The robber will be robbed. Those that have taken away the homes of others will be homeless. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land and of the city and of all that dwell therein. So again, whatever you gain by force, you'll lose by force. That's what he's telling them. And all the evil that any man may do will turn again upon his own head. On that, the Bible is very plain, here and many other places. Look at a statement in Isaiah 33 and verse 1. It's about the spoiler. Woe to thee that spoileth, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they deal not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. Goes back to the old law of reaping and sowing. God's not mocked. Whatever man sows, he'll also reap. He goes out and spoils somebody else, and God will send somebody to spoil him. There's no escape from that law of divine retribution. Then in the seventh Psalm, verse 16, there's found this scripture. His mischief shall return upon his own head, and his own violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate. Now that's again reaping what a man sows. When you look at the overall part, especially the latter part of the verse there, he describes the evil of the Chaldeans upon Judah in a threefold aspect. First of all, there would be murder and mistreatment of the citizens. He said men's blood. Men's blood. That's murder and mistreatment of the citizens. And then there would be wanton destruction of property. He said violence of the land and of the city. That's always the way invaders do. And then there would be harm to farm and forest, because he said, and all that dwell therein, everything's going to be devastated by these invaders. These spoilers are going to take a great spoil, but eventually the spoilers will be spoiled, the plunderers will be plundered, and the robbers will be robbed, and these that have taken away our homes will be themselves without a home. Well, we'll not go into that next woe, because it has to do with the sin of covetousness. He's talked about the sin of drunkenness and pride, and now he's going to talk about the sin of covetousness. And really, I believe he's going to tell us why these men wanted to be these great and mighty conquerors. It was because they were covetous. They wanted what somebody else had, you see.